Now, I don't know about you guys, but I know some people suffer from something that I've heard called dysfunctional closet syndrome. And this is where, for some reason, clothes come out of the dryer and sometimes into a basket, and then they just kind of end up in a pile somewhere. And they don't ever make it into that magical thing called a dresser or a closet. Some of us struggle with this more than others, right? You end up with clothes kind of everywhere. And what often happens is, if you're short on time for something, you don't really know where your outfits are. You just end up kind of grabbing the first thing, right? So, like this morning, you know, I could just grab my plaid jacket, right? And now here, this is appropriate for all occasions up in the north, right? Like, this is my good plaid. But, you know, there's some things, you know, you go through, and depending on what you're going to, like, you know, this is, you know, my, I'm just like bacon, I make everything better shirt is, again, appropriate for most occasions. It can go with a tie if I'm in a hurry, right? And you end up just grabbing stuff. And you know you've got stuff. Like, I know I've got a dress shirt, but I also know that I've got the jeans that Dana insists I can only wear mowing the lawn, right? And, you know, because sometimes, though, you're in a hurry and you just grab something because you can't find it. And you get these times where you end up, the only thing you can find is your dress pants, and you're going to go mow the lawn in them, and you're going to get in trouble. But you've just got to put something on, so you just grab it because you don't know where things are. And, you know, maybe you haven't, or you or your spouse haven't yet, you know, watched that Netflix documentary about the Japanese lady that puts everything in place. You know, I came home one day and found out that my sock drawer apparently didn't spark joy for Dana. And so my socks are now, you know, in this neat arrangement. But it's actually kind of funny because now that they're where they're supposed to be, I can actually pull out the right pair of socks when I'm going somewhere because they've been put in their place. This idea of what I term dysfunctional closet syndrome is often the way that, especially if we've grown up in the church, or, you know, we've heard lots about the Bible, we've studied it over the years, we end up with this idea that we know that there's things in there. And we pull something out and we're like, you know what, I know about David and Goliath, and I know about Jonah and the whale, but these two things don't go together in my head, and I don't know why. And so we need to have a reference point for how these things go together. And so in this next 4 weeks, we're going to go through at a really, really high level how the Old Testament fits together. How Jonah and Moses and David and Elijah and the burning bush and prophets of Baal and fire from heaven, and how these all fit together. And what we're going to do is, I want to give you 5 pegs to hang things on. So our starting point is going to be 5 pegs to hang things on, just like in our closet. Like in our closet, I mean, I actually do have some level of organization on my half of a closet. You know, I have a peg for my ties. I have a rack for my dress shirts. I have a bin of the clothes that are relegated to yard work in the shop. Okay, and so I'm not as scattered as I would otherwise be. And the same, when we come to the Bible, I want to help us to understand the big picture of the Bible by just giving us some pegs to hang things on. And these pegs that we hang things on underpin the grand narrative of the Bible. And I believe that once we get an idea of these pegs to hang things on, and then how everything hangs on them, we can understand the Bible in a much clearer way. And so before I tell you what these pegs are, there's a concept that runs throughout the Bible, and it's common in Middle Eastern culture, actually in most cultures around the world outside of our very individualistic North American culture, but the idea of kinship, of family. Now, we all have family of some size, shape, form, But particularly here in North America today, family doesn't have the same significance as it does in much of the world. In much of the world, you have your what we call our nuclear family, right? Like Dana and myself and Katie and Eli, we've got our nuclear family, and then we've got my sister and her husband and kids and my parents, and we kind of move up to my uncles and aunts, right? And you get a clan. And in most of the world, everybody knows exactly where they fit into this structure. They know, when I lived in the Middle East, it was mind-boggling. You go with somebody's like, oh yeah, well that's my uncle's son's husband's wife. Or like, just, you kind of go and you're like, what? And you know all these steps of kinship. And so kinship goes from family to clan to tribe and to society. And the world into which the Old Testament was written functioned on these levels, where you knew who your family was, you knew who your clan was, your tribe was, and society, and all of your relationships were key or were dependent on how you fit into this structure and how you were interconnected with people. You also had a level of authority. And so the further up this chain of authority you moved, the more responsibility you had, but the more authority you had. And it's when we understand that there is this hierarchy of, you know, if you needed something done, you'd go to the right person. If you had an issue with somebody, you go to their father or their grandfather or their uncle, or right, and family gets involved. And this is why we end up with things like multi-generational feuds and stuff, because everything you do in society is connected to where you fit in to this hierarchy. This is why even when we go to stories in the Bible, when we look at in the book of Ruth, which we looked at coming up to Christmas, when Boaz, when Ruth asks Boaz to redeem her, he's like, I would, but there's somebody closer. It's an example of this, that Boaz knew exactly how he was related to Ruth, to her deceased husband, her mother-in-law. And he knew that there was somebody else who was closer. So there was somebody that actually bore greater responsibility. And sometimes this is, you know, for us, it's a little hard to get our heads around this, because we're like, well, you know, if my cousin, my cousin Rich does something, I bear no responsibility for his actions. Whereas in a culture like this, if one of my cousins does something to somebody else, I'm like, oh, all of a sudden I could be in trouble, because that someone has got a cousin and an uncle and a second cousin and a third cousin, and they're married to this person. And so this whole idea of kinship is foundational to the way society worked in the time of the Old Testament and still in many parts of our world today. And so when we go from the idea of kinship, there's another piece to that, and that is called covenant. And this is a word that we talk about in the church. And today we talk about the covenant of marriage. We talk about a membership covenant. A covenant in biblical terms, in the cultural terms of the time the Bible came in, is the idea of actually creating kinship. And so we, even today, we create family, right? Dan and Christy created a family when they made a covenant together a few weeks ago, or however long ago that was. It was recently. They've covenanted, you know, made a covenant together to be husband and wife, and they created a family, the two of them who were not related. And they brought their lives together, and they will build a family together. But because of that, there's a relationship that didn't exist before. And for any of us that have married, that happens when we get married, because you don't just marry the individual, but often you end up with the whole family, right? And you end up with all these other relatives that you might not have chosen. But but you've made a covenant, and you become family. And in the ancient world, and again, in many parts of the world today, there's really two significant kinds of covenant beyond the covenant of marriage. When we are looking at covenants, there's the covenant between equals. And this would be like the covenant between two tribes that are not related, or two neighboring nations that are of roughly equal power. And it's the idea that, you know what, I'll protect you if those pesky people from Quesnel come in and invade us, you know, Vanderhoof's going to come and defend us, right? Like, it's that kind of mutual aid thing. And we see this even in many places today, you know, in government and rescue service, and we have those kind of mutual aid agreements. We've kind of made a covenant with other provinces, with other countries. When we need help, they'll come to our aid. Then the other kind is between a greater and a lesser power. And this is where often what we call like a vassal relationship, where a much greater power comes and says to a much weaker power, we are in covenant together now. Now, usually it wasn't entirely voluntary on both, on the weaker power's part, or sometimes it was. Sometimes it was just be a small power come and say, I need protection. And this came with all sorts of stipulations. And usually it involved the lesser power giving tribute to the greater power in form of taxes or conscripted military service or produce in exchange for the greater power's protection. Now, it wasn't, though, just about protection, and that wasn't necessarily always an ongoing thing, because there was also always stipulations of, so if you don't actually pay us all the taxes, yeah, we're just going to come and invade. And so there was often this real consequences to not upholding the covenant. And now this idea of covenant is important to understand, and we could dive much deeper in this, but we're going to stay at a high level and keep moving, because God is a God of covenants. And I said we're going to look at five pegs to hang the Old Testament on. Well, those five pegs are five covenants that God made. And those are Adam, with Noah, with Moses, sorry, Abraham, with Moses, and with David. Now, the reason why David is italicized and not bolded there is because we're just looking at the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And it's in those first five books of the Bible that we find the first four of these covenants. So I'm not leaving David off, I'm just leaving David for next week. So you got to come back. But God is a God of covenants, and God is the greater power. And so when we are looking at covenants, at the covenants that God makes, we have to recognize that these are all covenants of a much greater power. The God of the universe doesn't get much greater than that, making a covenant with mankind. And so this covenantal structure is something that resonates throughout the Bible. And as we go through it over the next 4 weeks, we're going to see how the different parts of the Old Testament hang on these covenants. And so the first one, as we go through Genesis through Deuteronomy, which is also the title there, is Pentateuch, is the word that sometimes gets tossed around. The first five books of the Bible go by several names, the Law, or in Hebrew, the Torah, or the Pentateuch, which is just Greek for five books. So there you go. You learned a little bit of Greek. You can, you know, a little bit smarter, a little bit more knowledge. But the first five books, the Pentateuch. And so the first peg that we see is going right back to the beginning. Because the Bible opens up with those words, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And of course, as we go through the creation account, God creates and orders creation, and the pinnacle of creation is the creation of man and woman. And so what we see in Genesis 1 and 2 is God's original intent with Adam and Eve. And we read, starting in verse 27, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves in the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. and to the beasts of the earth and the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. So God created all that there is. And he created the earth and all that is in it to work together. And he created us to be his rulers on earth. And the idea was that we would steward and we would take care of the earth. And that we would live in harmony with the earth and with God. That was God's intent. And that's where it all begins. But as we know how things went, Adam and Eve were put in the garden, and there was just one thing they were told not to do. And every one of us who's ever had a child anywhere near us knows the one way to ensure it seems that a kid does something is to tell them not to do it. And that's what Adam and Eve do. Our parents, Adam and Eve, did the one thing that they were told not to do. God gave them this wonderful, incredible place where they could live in harmony with all. And they did the one thing. So we get to Genesis chapter 3. One thing that they were told not to do. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us how long they were in the garden, whether they were able to live in this, in Eden, for years, for months. You know what? If it was me, I would think that they probably lasted, you know, maybe a day. Because I just know my own lack of self-control at times. And it's like, you know, that tree looks really, really good. We don't know, but we do know that they didn't last. That they did the one thing. And I won't read Genesis chapter 3, but in summary, the serpent comes in and he twists God's word and Eve tries the fruit. And Eve sees that it's good and she gives it to Adam, who's standing right there and holds actually more blame than Eve did, because he's the one that God had given the command to. He's the one who knew what God had said and would have known that the serpent was twisting God's words. But they taste the fruit, and their eyes are open, and they realize that they're naked. And God comes, and they hide. You can't hide from God. And in Genesis chapter 3, God lays out the results, the consequences of their sin, and the serpent is cursed. And we are told there that foreshadowing of God's redemption plan, that the serpent would crawl upon the ground and that he would strike the heel of Eve's son, and that her son would crush the serpent. The serpent is cursed. Eve is told that her pain in childbirth will be greatly increased. It's important to note that God does not curse the man. They have to live out the consequences of their sin. But the consequences are going to be heavy. And Eve not only is she now going to have to live outside the garden, but her childbearing will be painful. And this goes beyond just simply, and it's not simply, not to minimize childbirth, because I know it's a big deal. And yeah, Dane almost broke one of my fingers. squeezing the hand. So, sidebar, guys, if your wife's going to have a child, take your wedding ring off, because it really hurts when they squeeze. That's a freebie. But Eve, when you look at God's original intent for Adam and Eve was to be the mother of all. In the garden where they lived in harmony, Eve was going to be the mother who had the perfect relationship with her daughters, her granddaughters. It's part of Eve's consequences is it says that her desire will be for her husband, and there's different ways to translate that word, but it really points towards a relational brokenness. And Eve, who was going to be the mother of all and would live in harmony with her husband, in harmony with her kids, now childbearing, and not just the actual act of childbirth, but the whole act of mothering is going to be painful. Because the relationship is broken. And Adam also is going to face consequences. The ground is now cursed. Again, Adam and Eve are not cursed, but their lives are now much more difficult. We're told that his work will now be toilsome. That should be now, not. Sorry, that's a typo on my notes. But his work is going to be toilsome. You see, we were created to work. God created Adam and Eve, and he put them in the garden to care for it and to tend it. And it was to be good. But now the ground is going to produce thorns. And this is something that we see even much starker when we know that the Hebrew word for ground is Adama. And so we're told that the Adam and the Adama, who were created for each other, are now going to work against each other. And just like for Eve, the relationships that she was supposed to have that would be harmonious and wonderful are now going to be broken. Adam, whose work he was created for, the very thing that God designed him for, is now going to frustrate him. And that is the state that we are left in at the end of Genesis chapter 3. But God made the promise there that the serpent would be crushed. And so that is the first peg that we have to keep in mind as we read the Old Testament, that God's intended purpose was to live with us in harmony in the garden. That his original intent was for us to have harmonious relationships with each other, for our work to be satisfying. But the garden left us in a place of brokenness. It left us in a place of broken and dysfunctional relationships. It left us in a place of toilsome and unfulfilling. But God promised that the serpent would be crushed. And so with that, we move to the second peg, and that is Noah. Because the chapters that follow Genesis 4 to 6 tell us what happened outside the garden. And what happens is that God left mankind to do as they pleased. Adam and Eve did not want to listen to God. They wanted to grasp that knowledge, to be like God. It's interesting as you look at many of the myths and legends from around the world of past, of the origins of culture and of the earth, many cultures have these incredible stories like Atlantis, that there was this age of incredible knowledge and wisdom and power, and that somehow it was all lost. And the Bible, on the other hand, tells us that there was this age where man ignored God. And it was not the pinnacle of wisdom and knowledge and power, but it was the pinnacle of depravity. And so God, seeing his creation, seeing his people that he created go their own way, it finally comes to the point where God says, I have to clean this up. I can't let the depravity of man go any further. And so he calls Noah. And we know the story, the animals, two by two, Noah builds the ark, and Noah and his family are saved. And we read in Genesis chapter 8, 21 to 22, after the flood, Noah offers a sacrifice to God, and we read The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. And so we have the promise of God that he would not wipe out mankind again, that he would persevere, that he would continue to call us, to pursue us. He saves mankind through this promise. And so we have the promise of Noah that God will not destroy. And so we see the next peg, that of Abraham. This is where God launches his redemption story. He promised it in the garden. He promised Noah that he would not destroy us. And here, once we get to Genesis chapter 11 and 12, we have the call of Moses. And in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, we have the Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. And I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you. See, this is the promise that God made to Abram, whom he later renamed Abraham. And it's a promise of a land, that God would give him a land. Verse 1. It's the promise that he will make him into a great nation, that Abraham would be the father of a great nation, and that Abraham would be a blessing to all the earth. And this covenant is vital to the understanding of the Old Testament, the promise of land, the promise of nationhood, the promise of blessing all mankind. And as we move through the Bible, as we trace the story of the nation of Israel, who is that nation that God promised Abraham, as we trace their journey through the rest of Genesis, and we see that promise starting to unfold with, first of all, Abraham, and all that goes on with first Ishmael, when Abraham and Sarah took things into their own hands, with Isaac, the son that God promised. And then, of course, Isaac had Jacob and Esau. And it's when you get to that point, you're like, well, God promised to make him a great nation, but right now we're like literally at two descendants. And God continued faithfully. And of course, Jacob and his 12 sons and the journey to Egypt. And this is where we have the story of Joseph being sold by his brothers into slavery, of going and ending up in Egyptian prison, ending up being exalted to being the second highest in the kingdom. This is all part of the story of Abraham and the promise that was made to him by God. And we see, by the time we get to the end of Genesis, we see that they're not in the land, but as a nation, they're growing. And we get to the next book of the Bible, the book of Exodus, and we find out that in the time that the Israelites have been slaves in Egypt, they have grown to a great multitude. And it brings us to our fourth peg, Moses. Moses is one of the most significant figures in the Old Testament. The leader of the Israelites. The one who was put as a baby in the basket in the reeds. Found by Pharaoh's daughter, raised in Pharaoh's court. Flees out to the wilderness after he kills an Egyptian, has the burning bush experience where God calls him to go back, where he goes before Pharaoh and the 10 plagues that happen and that refrain that he repeats over and over, let my people go, until Pharaoh finally realizes that Moses really does serve the God of the universe. Moses leads the people out of Egypt through the Red Sea. God miraculously delivers them, takes them to Sinai, where God gives them the covenant, where he calls them as his people. The book of Deuteronomy is the recounting of this covenant. And as we look at the book of Deuteronomy, we see that God calls his people. He tells them who they are. He tells them what he expects of them. Deuteronomy chapter 5 is where we find the Ten Commandments. The retelling of them. We find them in Exodus, but we find them here in Deuteronomy. And we find in Deuteronomy that God calls his people to a covenant relationship with him. And we get to Deuteronomy chapter 6, where we read this. These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that your children and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live, by keeping all his decrees and commands that I give you, so that you may enjoy long life. Hear, Israel, and be careful to obey, so that it may go well with you, and you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised you. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. All these commands that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and your gates. This is the part of the preamble of Moses' message in Deuteronomy. That the nation of Israel is to serve God, to love him with all their hearts. This is the verse that when Jesus asked what's the greatest commandment, he says to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. This is what he's going back to. This forms the basis of all that comes after it in the Old Testament and pointing us to the new. As you go through Deuteronomy, we find that there are a lot of commands in it, but there's a lot of promises. There's promises of blessings to the nation if they follow God, and there's promises of exile if they disobey. This, as you read through the book of Deuteronomy, it very much holds the structure of one of these vassal relationship covenants between a significant power and between a lesser power that cannot defend itself. And God, throughout the book of Deuteronomy, lays out what it means to live as his people. As you look at the covenant that God makes with his people here in Deuteronomy, you see that he knows that they're not going to obey. He knows that they're going to have a hard time following him. He knows that they are going to end up in exile, but there is also the promise that he will bring them back. The covenant that's laid out here in Deuteronomy is fundamental to understanding the rest of the Old Testament. But it's also fundamental to understanding the whole of the Bible, the Old and New Testament. As I said, we have one more peg, and we're going to talk about that next week with David. But I just want to wrap it up at this point by showing you how God's plan of redemption goes through these pegs, these covenants that we have to hang everything on. And that is, first of all, when we look at God's original intent with Adam and Eve in the garden, we see that it was God's desire to dwell with all mankind. His intent was to live with us in harmony, to dwell with him. Oh, him. We're told that he walked in the garden with Adam and Eve. He wasn't some far-off, distant power out there that just created stuff and left it. He created us for relationship. He created us for relationship with him and with each other. God's original intent was a people who knew him intimately, who loved him, who followed him, who walked with him and walked together. And so God's original intent was for all mankind, every man, woman, and child, to walk in his presence. But we couldn't do it. And so we had the fall. But God promised in that seed of his redemption was that the promise that the serpent would be crushed. And so then we see Noah. And we see in the time leading up to Noah, the absolute depravity of man. But through Noah, God saved one man and his family. Salvation came through one man in Noah. But then we get to Abraham and we see that salvation is going to come through one family. God is calling Abraham and his descendants. His one family is through that family, the promise of God, the promise of salvation is going to come. And then we get to Moses, our fourth peg, and we see salvation comes through a whole nation. But it doesn't end there. Because as we take that trajectory through the whole of the Old Testament and into Christ, we have the Gospels, we have Christ coming to earth, dwelling among us, teaching, living, dying on a cross, and rising from the dead. And then we have at Pentecost the establishment of the church. We're jumping out of the Old Testament to the church, which is salvation for all. Not salvation for one man who builds a boat. Not salvation for one man who God calls and promises to become a great nation. Not salvation just for one nation that God calls out of exile. But salvation for all who put their faith in Jesus Christ. For all who recognize that, yes, I am broken. And I am broken and dysfunctional because Adam and Eve, every one of my ancestors that followed, was intent on doing things their own way. Salvation for every one of us who have looked at that and said, yeah, God, I know that I'm broken, and I know that only you can fix me. Salvation comes through all who have placed their faith in Christ, and if you've placed your faith in Christ, you are a part of the church. If you are a follower of Christ, you are called. And you are a part of his church. And it is available to every man, woman, and child, every race, every tongue, every tribe. See, God is a God of covenants. And he made these covenants in the Old Testament with his people as we went along. But when we get to the New Testament, he made another covenant. And that's what we celebrate this morning. And I'd ask if the deacons could just come and help me serve as we celebrate the covenant of Christ. Because God, right from Genesis chapter 3, it's clear that God was not going to abandon mankind. It is clear that the creation that God made mattered. That every man, woman, and child that he knew from eternity past, who is ever going to walk the face of the earth, this earth, mattered. And And that though we are broken, dysfunctional, so we are prone to wander, so we carry our sin, He provided a way out. And we are told that the night before Jesus was betrayed, or the night that Jesus was betrayed before He went to the cross, that He did this with His disciples. And He used covenant language because He speaks of the cup and He says, this cup is the new covenant in My blood. See, all the other covenants that He made in the Old Testament, especially when we look at the history of Israel, and that's what we're going to look at next week. We're going to see that the nation that He called to be His covenant people just failed. And so He came and He made a perfect sacrifice and fulfilled the law that He had laid down, and He provided a way. And so if you've placed your faith in Christ, you are a part of the new covenant. And it's not by your own merit. It's not because you're extra special, because you were better than all the rest. Because you are made in the image of God, and He loves you, and He cared for you, and He pursued you, and He sent His Son to die for you. And if you have, if that is a reality and a truth in your life, then this table is for you.